This program is brought to you by Resonance FM. If you like what you hear, please support our work by making a donation at resonancefm.com/donate.
Good afternoon. This week, a welcoming wave from Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the World Wide Web. Why Wavelength, you may wonder wistfully. Well, for 3 weeks, we at Wavelength are weaving our practice with that of Chris Weaver, studio engineer at Resonance. We are waiving our regular programming, and some of you may recall the end of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, mad being an upside-down W, of course, when the hapless bunch of gold diggers are pursuing treasure hidden below a mysterious big W. For a while, they all wander around hopelessly, until the most mentally challenged member of the team notices that the palm trees behind them spell out a big W. They all exclaim, "The big W," and run towards it with shovels. Well, Chris Weaver has brought Dan Wilson along this week to prove the old saying, "Where there's a will, son, there's a way." Aged only 19, Dan Wilson hosted the Hellbore show on Resonance and issued a CD called Tongue Under a Ton of Nine Volters on the Alcohol label under the name Meadow House. An altered quote from Dan: "Media dropping, the dropping of homemade CDs, DVDs, tapes, books, manuscripts, etc., in public places for random people to find. Media dropping is a pathological habit of mine," says Dan. "My old Resonance show, the exciting Hellbore show, documented many media droppings in detail, or tape droppings, as I referred to them back then, as cassette was the weapon of choice. Special music was consigned to cassette or CDR and scattered hither and thither. Over time, an instrumentarium was built up specifically geared toward sonically shocking, unsuspecting media dropping recipients. Media dropping may be seen as a physical analogue of the crap flooding and trolling phenomena of the internet age, but this is a debatable comparison. Cassette is the common denominator. Buying and selling books is the support system, the last refuge of the unemployable." Welcome to Dan Wilson and Chris Weaver, who are going to assist me or help me with this week's Wavelength.
So, hello, Dan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so this is the, as William said, this is the second show looking at people whose musical practice or their sort of musical... their musical techniques revolve around tape. And I first met Dan when he was doing the Hellebore show on Resonance. I was engineering for him many moons ago. And as I've come to know him better, this incredible sort of backstory has emerged where these tapes, in as I was saying to you earlier, in a sort of stark contrast to Adam Bowman, who was very much plugged into this international network of people sending tapes and exchanging tapes, Dan very much existed in a vacuum. He's, you know, he was working on tape solely for your own pleasure, I suppose, and also we'll probably come on to sort of psychological attempts to affect the surrounding, a bit Burroughs-like.
Yeah, there's a kind of cathartic effect, I suppose, with the tapes. But it did actually, it did emerge from complete isolation. One of the first tracks, actually, that I thought would be appropriate for you to play is actually emerges from the culture of the tracking scene, which is a kind of in the 1990s, there was software available. These were vertically scrolling sequences, like such as Scream Tracker and Fast Tracker 2. And on these pieces of software, you can load in samples and record your own things, and they get saved with the files. It's quite an alien concept nowadays because of MP3s and things like that, which with these songs you could take them apart and look at them and remix them and things, because the sounds and the sequence would be stored themselves. And this song that I've picked, that I think might be a good way to start it, is a kind of combination of this tracking technique with covert cassette recordings of My Next Door Neighbor.
Okay, let's launch into the first track then, and we'll discuss it afterwards.
Don't Be a Bad Dog.
Don't be a bad dog.
Bobby, come on. Right, yeah, come on. Right. Hey. Come on. Hey. Come on.
We were talking during the track, so you were 14 when you made that.
Yeah.
How did you do the recording, the covert recording?
This was a dictaphone left in a bush.
And you were waiting. This is, presumably your neighbours were loud, quite
they're
noisy.
They're very. You can tell whenever something was going to happen because the dog would start barking and it would kind of rouse them into a loud activity. And I recorded the sound, and you can hear it's a very noisy recording. I was using a little handheld dictaphone, and I used some of the noise as a kind of percussion in the song. So you can hear the tape noise actually becomes part of the hi-hat. because it was so noisy, I just thought I'd try and incorporate it somehow. And there's a kind of backstory for the, well, not a backstory, but it kind of when I recorded the song, I was at school and I was playing it to some people. There's three of us in a room, one of the languages department room, and we were playing it on one of their tape machines. And the teacher came in, quite a butch languages teacher, and she said, "What's this?" And I said, "Oh, it's nothing." And then everyone said, "Oh, it's Dan's music. He recorded his neighbours." She goes, "Let me hear it." So I went, "Oh, I can." So he played it, and we were sort of giggling a bit. And then she said, "This is brilliant. I know someone in Shack Attack, and this could probably get in the charts." And I said, "Could get in the charts?" She said, "Yeah. Just give me a tape of it, and because I really like this." I said, "Oh, wow, yeah, I'd like to get in the charts. Yeah, I'd be on the chart show, top of the pop." But then someone said afterwards, "Don't give her the tape. She's doing it as a ruse because she suspects that we're stealing her tapes from her languages cupboard," which I was. There was a kind of repository in the cupboard where the pupils' spoken word assessments would be stored under alphabetical order, and they were on very distinctive Hertfordshire County Council tapes. And well, I'd use those tapes on the tape droppings, as I'll describe later. And so we were a bit scared that maybe I shouldn't give her the tape. But in the end, I did give her a tape. In the end, I bought the tape and dubbed her off a copy of it. And she left the school shortly afterwards.
She probably became famous on the back of it.
Yeah.
That kind of led nicely because you mentioned, like, a lot of your tape, kind of psychological tape experiments were, as you described them, you would compose music on tape to modify people's behaviour in a certain sense.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to give the impression that this is all, we're listening to this funny music and everyone's having a nice time. It became quite a solitary approach. And there'd be a point where the bullies and the loud, brutish people, I'd think, hang on, that they shouldn't be, they're causing a lot of misery, these bullies, and there must be a nice creative way to get back at them. And I'd use their own voices sometimes, using the cupboard, the languages cupboard, with all their French and Spanish and German assessments. I'd take their actual voice and incorporate that into some horrible song and then record it back onto a tape and then leave that tape in their locker or in their gym PE bag or something for them to find. And then trying to watch carefully and see if their behaviour changes and they become more softer and more nice. It didn't always work. In fact, it only really worked once. It was quite a cathartic experience because you could vent some anonymous miasma and await the results. Like an experiment, really.
Did you do this often? Or many people receive their own personalised sort of psychological tape?
It would happen quite often. If I saw one of the fourth formers pushing someone downstairs, or if someone insulted me,
it wouldn't just be at you, it'd be like,
oh no, it was
justice.
I mean, I was bullied as well. It's not a kind of righteous thing. It's like, you know, it's quite a personally felt project. Yeah, and unfortunately a lot of these tapes don't survive because I would use a kind of stock backing and then make vile pronouncements over this backing with their information, like their star sign or their home address and their mum's profession. So unfortunately these tapes were unique and not many of them survived. I'm not a very good archive. I don't really keep much of my stuff, actually, and I had a hard time selecting stuff for your show because mostly when I collect other people's stuff, I've got stuff from the Leg tapes and early Resonance contributor Piggy Bank and Westwood the Bard. I don't know, these very obscure. But then I don't keep my own stuff in very good order.
What were you sort of listening to at this time? Was there anything that influenced you at the time?
I was listening to all sorts of things. I was listening to, in 1996, I have to say this, I was listening to Sonic Youth and Portishead and Chemical Brothers. You can hear the influence there of Underworld and on that Don't Be a Bad Dog. It's a bit... But then when I started doing the tapes, the influences all fell away. I think you'll find on this next track, actually, which is called 40 Foot Well, which contains radio recordings, it's just a kind of anything that happens to be within hitting range, really, any objects. So there's no influences there, I don't think.
So that's a million miles away from your first sort of musical outing, and you did say the sort of influences fell away, but that's quite a sharp trajectory. I mean,
yeah, well, you have to. I had to be anonymous, and there's that you can kind of hide behind that kind of sound and be anonymous. And also, there's a. I felt that why should I? I don't know. I thought I'm following all these fashions and feeling obliged to add a little 303 sound in a trance song or something. I thought, why am I doing this? I don't really like it. I do like it, but then I thought it doesn't. I'm not getting the cathartic effect. It became a bit more noisy, and it was quite a sharp. You're right. It was a sharp, sudden cut around 1996 to 98, I suppose.
Were you listening to more experimental music at this point, or
no, not really?
So this is really a pure, just an outlet of sound.
I had no idea that. Well, actually, that I was receiving tapes from different people at the time, and we'd try and outshock each other with different.
Okay, so explain a little bit about this.
They were internet correspondents. Various. The interestingnesses were exchanged. I suppose that was partly an influence as well. But I think mainly it was a kind of just an attempt to hide behind sheer volume. And
This song's called 40 Foot Well, and what's the significance of the title? Was this aimed at something?
I turned on the radio at the end, and someone just happened to say, a 40 Foot Well. Okay. And I thought, well, that's the title of that song. Although that would actually be a stock backing, and I'd use that to make it more unique, targeted tape. As I said, those tapes are gone now because they've been dropped. So the tape deck I had one cassette to another, and it also had a microphone socket where you could overdub as well at the same time.
Where did this one go?
Oh, I can't remember. A couple of lockers, I think. It may have gone to a teacher. One of them went to one of the science teachers who was... she wasn't strict, but the classes would be so uncontrollable. In fact, I felt, I shouldn't really do it. What a silly thing to do. I regret doing it.
Was it around this time you started making music for your own pleasure? Like, not just tapes to send away, but as a sort of...
There was a kind of crossover, that kind of input, that kind of, what's the word, the inner troll was working the other direction too. So I was actually recording things covertly. Don't Be a Bad Dog, that was a covert recording of a neighbour. And I started incorporating things I'd recorded at school as well. There's one I've chosen here, which actually my dad describing a jazz party. He's a jazz musician, and he at one gig he played at, someone was so drunk it caused such a disgrace, and he described it in a quite nice way, and I covertly recorded him describing it afterwards, and then I put some kind of square pressure-y influence thing over it. I don't know what the influence is really. I just kind of did the sound, hopefully to capture the spirit of what he was describing.
And the instrumental parts are using the sequencer you mentioned earlier?
By now I was actually trying to get out of that rigid sequencer thing and trying to make it a bit more loose. Yeah.
So you were overdubbing?
Yeah, overdubbing things and like recorders and penny whistles and bits of percussion and stuff like that.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, let's have a listen.
It's called Doug's Piss Up.
Doug's Piss Up.
Oh, it's terrible. One of Doug's friends is always pissed.
And he had a woman with him who I'd never seen before. And she was... They were both half pissed to start with. And then towards the... As we got to the coffee, so we'd had the main course the first bit, she was sat on the chair like this. And then suddenly, she just went... Like that. And she just... knocked out. Thinking, alcoholic poisoning, I think, or not poisoning, just drunk and stupid. But she was like that for half an hour, and then for some reason, whether she moved or someone moved the chair, something moved, and suddenly she just fell on the floor in the middle of the restaurant, from the small restaurant, and never even woke up. She didn't bang her head on, she just sort of rolled on the floor. Her glasses went up like that, she was laying there, and they couldn't wake her up. And the bloke that was with her was a friend of Doug's, and he's always pissed. He's trying to wake her up. In the end, he's on the floor. He couldn't get up. A big bloke. And there's a two of them on the floor, knocked out. What a way to behave! Absolutely disgraceful.
But I mean, that guy, he's terrible. He's he drives pissed. He'll kill somebody one day. Really, totally irresponsible.
Slightly caught unawares there by the surprise ending.
You can hear then there was a kind of combination of that kind of covert tape recording again of recording my dad without knowing he's being recorded, because he would behave differently if he knew he's being recorded. He'd describe the whole incident completely differently and it wouldn't work.
So did you hide the recorder in the house? Would it be sort of secretly behind books or something?
Yeah, it was behind, it was behind
exactly.
Books, yeah. It was on the top shelf.
the strategy.
Yeah. And it was kind of, I cleaned up the hiss this time, so you can't, it's very cleaner recording. I don't know what else to say.
Well, while that was playing, we were talking about at this period, it was sort of tapes as a sort of medium that everyone used were sort of waning, weren't they?
Really? I couldn't quite remember whether cassette was still a kind of viable format at that time, or whether it was already on its way out.
I think it really began its decline around 2000, 2002, perhaps.
Right.
But back then, I mean, 1998 to 1999, you had CD recorders, but they were really expensive. And there's always someone who knew someone else's dad that had a CD recorder, and he'd do copies of CDs, which was an amazing thing then. Mm. And then there was mini discs, but they were very expensive. So tapes were quite well available as well. They were cheap. You could go to car boot sales and things, and you could find tapes on the ground. And, you know, the languages cupboard, as I said, which at school that had all these cassettes, which I would sneakily pilfer. Mm. The cassettes, there's kind of abundance of cassettes around. It's like a final glory, the death throes of the cassette. We had this last glorious cassette.
There was a period you were telling me before the show was when you started, you made a re-spooling device because you were very interested in collecting tape.
I was interested in finding, I would have liked it if other people were more interested in tape dropping, leaving tapes around, because I didn't just do targeted tape droppings for people. I made tape droppings, actually Doug's Piss Up, that song, was on an anonymous tape dropping left in public somewhere. You could leave them in the laundrette or in the street, and just for people to find. And back then, people would be more liable to pick up the cassette and say, "What's this?" I think nowadays people look at it and say, "What's this?"
I suppose with like a CD, you know, there's this whole aura of like viruses and it might be something that could damage me. But I suppose a tape is quite innocuous and quite innocent. And you know how it works.
Yeah, you know it's audio. That's the only thing that could be on the tape. It's going to be something audio. But with CDs, it could be data or video or something more.
With the cassettes that you left, say, in a laundrette, was there any ambition whatsoever with this thing of where the cassette might end up?
I'd tailor a series of songs about the laundrette. There's Leper in a Tumble Dryer, which was one song. I mean, they're done very off the cuff. They're just kind of done very quickly and just made a tape full of laundrette themed songs. Or a graveyard cassette, which is full of graveyard themed songs.
It sounds so, it's pretty willfully obscure, isn't it? It is like trying to vanish almost. You're kind of being anonymous. The tape is being left. It might get found. It might not. Well, it's almost like you're trying to disappear as an artist or something.
You're just submitting to the chaos of the world and just saying, "I hope someone finds this." But then that becomes magnified. If someone does find it, that the whole experience becomes intensified because you've found this whole little world, this cassette. I mean, imagine if you'd found a cassette and then picked it up and listened to it. You go, "Wow, I must be the only person who's... heard this. What is it?" And there's this confusion. The internet wasn't as prolific then. Not everybody had the internet, and so you couldn't really Google lyrics or phrase. You didn't know what was going on. As I said, the tape spooling device was a kind of inside of an old pricing gun from a shop, which labels goods. I don't think you see them much anymore, actually. You sticks the prices on. I took that apart and it fitted a motor and part of an old cassette Walkman. So I could, by the side of the road, you'd often see streamed cassettes, which you don't see anymore, this tape in the bushes and everything.
Wrapped into... There was a time, apparently, about three different artists were all gathering those tapes. I think each one of them thought they'd discovered it as an idea, but I can't remember who they all...
Zoe Irvin was one of them. Magnetic Migration Project.
Right.
She was collecting the tape trails around immigration centres, actually.
Oh, really?
So she was going to immigration centres around the perimeter and sort of collecting all this strewn music, basically.
Right.
Yours was more, I suppose, yours was along the side of motorways and stuff.
It was just in the town where I lived. It wasn't as conceptually driven as Irvine's project. And I don't think I could claim priority on it, because I think there are other people doing it as well. But I was just like naturally curious to see if there's anything on those cassettes which I could then use in my own tape droppings as well. Because it's at the kind of amplification of the mystery, taking some teenagers trying to do a rendition of Karma Chameleon, for instance, and then finding that's something I found. And she's trying to overdub herself, apparently using two or three tape recorders, from what I can hear. And it's all going out of tune, and the tape, because it's been outside, it's stretched, and it's horrible. There's another song I found, actually, which I didn't know what it was for a long time. It was a piece of high-energy music called... This is quite a recent thing, actually, 2002 or something, and it was a Pizza Hut song, the fast food song by the Pizza Hut, Kentucky Fried Chicken and Pizza Hut. It's a nightmarish song, and it was done in a kind of a nice upbeat pop way. And when I found the tape, it's like somebody had physically tried to ruin it, and it was stretched in some parts of it. And it was just a nice experience to find that.
Would you ever have left one of these cassettes in a music shop?
Oh, yeah. I'd actually, in a music... I went into instrument shops, music shops, but also in... The Virgin had V shops, which aren't around anymore, where I'd deposit my CDs and I'd try and reseal them into vacuum-sealed packs and peel off some of the old buy two for £2 or £2 and then adding them to the shelves.
Right.
And that's something I did.
I wonder if any got bought.
One of them was found, and I had an email from someone, Barnaby Green or someone, and he said makes the Velvet Underground sound like Bryan Adams.
So you did get a response. You would get it would boomerang back on you
in
some way.
In around 2002, I began adding email addresses onto these cassettes that I left in the wilderness. So I could harvest responses.
Some
tapes were targeted anonymously and others were intended to elicit a response.
Should we go to another piece of music?
I think this one is called 17 Years Ago, The Hard Drive Crash. This is an interesting point, actually, in a kind of my musical trauma. The hard drive crashed. So those techno days of Don't Be a Bad Dog all kind of become inaccessible. The only thing I could rescue from the hard drive was this extremely strange loop, which went 17 years ago. And I thought, well, I didn't do this. Or did I? Perhaps I did do it. And then I realised it probably related to a story or something. But you play it and see.
17 years ago,
right. Basically, I'm a detective. I'm officially a detective since about 17 years ago. I've been watching this house because there was a strange thing at the house just down the road. 17 years ago, there lived this man and a woman, and I think they were married. All I remember is these really loud arguments they'd have. But something happened one day, a weird thing. It was a spontaneous combustion. Well, it doesn't happen every day, does it? Weird. The man allegedly burst into flames in front of the TV and died. According to his wife, anyway.
What, are you talking about the woman down the road?
Yeah.
Well, she's a bit...
Can you hang on a moment?
I always thought she was a bit funny.
Don't get involved. So the funny thing is that after the spontaneous combustion of this man... 17 years ago, she didn't seem very upset, the wife. And you'd think she'd spend a while grieving for a dead husband who died in this strange fire before she found new love. But after this spontaneous combustion happened, about 2 days later, a new man moved in. It was a slightly younger man. 10 years ago? Yeah, I'm not saying it was deliberate, but that she might have planned this fire, or even fed her old partner lighter fluid. I'm not saying it's deliberate. 17 years ago, but it makes you think, doesn't it? Anyway, the reason I'm bringing all this stuff up now, and all this stuff that happened all that time ago, about 17 years ago, because a similar thing has happened again to the same lady in the same house the other day. Just like 17 years ago, there was a fire, just like the one that happened all those 17 years ago, and a partner of 17 years has died again, and someone else, a younger man, immediately moved in. It's very strange. I'm not saying it's deliberate. I'm not saying she's a murderer. I'm not saying that she's a murderer or whatever. It just very. It doesn't make sense. It just makes you wonder, doesn't it? 17 years ago. 17 years ago. It makes you think, doesn't it? 17 years ago. 17 years ago. 17 years ago, what do you think? 17 years ago. 17 years ago. 17 years ago.
So you, as that track was playing, I said, oh, how's the loop made, expecting some you'd say it was some kind of tape loop or something.
No, but when the hard drive crashed, I was just loading in streams of raw data into the working computer to see if I could rescue any sound. And as I was listening to all the white noise, and that just popped out, and there was the loop points were already set. And this was actually in Fast Tracker 2, which had the option to load in raw data. Actually, this brings us nicely to the next track, which if you load in into Fast Tracker 2 raw data, you get data noise. And if you set the loops, you actually get nice chiptune things, which you can cut down. Chiptune is when you try and make a song all in one file, as small as possible. And I was quite interested in the idea of making the most annoying melodies possible and taking it to the limits. This one's not mediocre, really. It's not that annoying. It's untitled.
And was this for someone to receive, or this was just part of your catalogue?
This is just filler for tape droppings. So to keep people interested, you can't just have constant noise. You need to oscillate between the noise and some catchy melody.
So at this point, you've almost been developing musically as a result of producing all these tapes for people. I mean, how many tapes do you think you ended up creating?
I don't know, hundreds. It doesn't sound that many, really, because when I was thinking how many I dropped in 2005 when I was keeping track, I did a specific project to try and during the Hellebore days, I think, and I only dropped about 200 in 1 year, which isn't actually, that's not even one a day, and most of those were duplicates. So if there's 200 that year, that was quite an intensive year. I would say at least 50 a year, I think.
And so this would have all new material, or you were producing constantly?
Yeah. It was quite constant, yeah. And most of the stuff has been recycled, so that's why I don't really keep any of my old stuff, because the songs on the four-track tape recorder would gradually, as I was overdubbing and making more adjustments and make targeting things, tracks would be lost, and then the songs would gradually change into something else. This one was just a digital song. This next one is short. You can only need to play the first minute or so of this one. This one's made from binary noise, and it sounds quite chirpy. It's a short burst.
So it was around, I mean, around this point, I mean, by now you're producing all these tapes, you're sending them, you're sort of developing quite a conscious theory of, you know, how these tapes are travelling and how they're being picked up and they're sort of how they reflect in society a bit.
I was trying to justify it a bit because it's a bit of a strange thing to do, and I was doing pamphleteering as well, so there'd be essays. I wasn't quite conscious of what I was doing. I was quite... just doing what I felt was...
Can I say, did you see it as an art project, or sound art, or was it just an obsessive compulsion?
It was a compulsion. I don't think it was really...
You didn't think of it as art?
No, I don't think it was. I still don't think it is, really, but I have to kind of say it is to try and get funding, which I never get. It's just a kind of I don't know. I'll talk later about some projects I've made from found materials. But at that time I wasn't consciously aware of really what was going on. But then you're right. I did gradually start philosophizing on it. And as William quoted from at the start was for some quotes from the philosophy of media dropping, from a kind of semi-published. Book dropping out, and there's various newspaper reports quoted as well. There was one incident where the newspaper reported three businesses complained of being targeted by a man making CDs, and they're looking into whether an offence has been committed under the menacing communications, sending a menacing communication. And that was about 2004, 2005. And by then, all these laws were coming in, new internet laws to stop trolling and incitement to murder and things like that. Although it was just a kind of benign, benign bits of interestingness. I wouldn't say
so. There wasn't a hint of menace about
I think they were slightly menacing.
Oh.
But
in what
I was targeted. Well, I was. So, you'll see in a minute. There's a one Fairground of Despair, but I don't know if it's really. Menacing. It's only menacing if you're for a very sensitive disposition. I made efforts to find companies that really were people that really.
And these would have had your email on it still, or at this point. So they knew where they were coming
some
from.
Some of them. If I was very intrigued to get a response, there was one that was sent to a youth club where the one of the managers was involved in a strange incident. I can't remember what it. What do you remember what it was? I read it out once on radio. And I can't remember what it was. I don't know if he was having an affair or something. I just thought, I'll do a little song because he was such a tight arse. He's a kind of military orientated man. And once he asked me something in the street. Said, have you got the time or something? And I said something, and he said, "Oh, do you want to speak up? I imagine." and I thought, he's getting a tape.
I'm surprised at this point you just didn't carry them on your person all the time.
Oh yeah, I did. There's always one in my pocket, and whenever the circumstance, whenever the whenever the situation seemed appropriate, I'd drop one. Yeah.
These are all CDs now. You've moved on from cassettes at this point.
No, this was still tapes. I don't know. Are we talking chronologically still? The chronology is a bit out, really, because some of it I can't really.
Well, was there a point where you hung on to cassette, knowing that it had become obsolete, and you'd part? You know, it was kind of you wanted to continue with the old.
That was around 2005, I think, and then I made a conscious decision to try and move on to CDs, which wasn't as satisfying or successful, or even I don't know. Well, I hadn't got many responses at all from CD dropping, so the kind of recording improved a bit at this time because I'd stopped using my 4-track tape recorder, or was only partially using it, and some of it was being digitally recorded, like this next track, Fleas.
Should we go into the next track?
Do you want to if you want. Okay, it's a nice example.
As I need. be around when I'm feeling down. You're so smooth and brown, you never make much sound. Please crawl in over me. Please, I like your company. You need me as much as I need thee. When I was assaulted near the fish and chip shop, I got home and cried, but fleas were there right by my side, kissing me goodnight.
So I was saying, kind of, again, quite musically more mature, and has sort of moved away from the computer into a lot of percussion and sort of instruments.
Yeah, there's a lot less electronic noises, and it became more about just the instruments that I just found lying about, and not even bothering to tune up anything. There's a prepared piano in there, actually, with all the strings, pots and pans lying on the strings. But it was around this time when most of the material on the album, Tongue Under a Ton of Nine Volters, most of the material had the same sound because it was being digitally produced. And there was various treatments, spring reverbs and things like that. And I began using found objects a lot more, found instruments and building instruments as well. And at this time it became more trying to improve the efficiency of tape dropping and but CD dropping to some extent by creating sounds that haven't been heard before. And to do that, you have to dive into the unknown and look at a chair in a different way and think, how can I get a sound from that that makes it striking and makes people want to carry on listening to the tape, but at the same time provide an unpleasant listening experience? Does that make sense?
It's still about alienating people.
No, not really. Not definitely, because it's about alienating. Then you're going, come back. Alienate. Come back. Because you want them to carry on listening to the tape, but you want them to fully absorb the message.
So there's a sort of mild alien. Well, yeah.
Yeah, that Fleas song.
Sour. Actually, it's a slightly soured experience.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I don't think that Fleas song I just played there was intended actually for specifically for tape dropping. It's just a piece of filler, almost like a piece of pseudo-pop in between the grot. To keep people listening, because it almost sounds well produced, but it's not. It's actually terribly produced. It's made from.
Were you called Meadow House at this time? Was that the name?
Meadow House was. I think it was a friend's name of a friend's house, because I was trying to draw him in and say, "Come on, make some music with me," but he didn't.
Okay.
And at this point, you're sort of doing a lot more musical projects. At this point, it's like 2005. So yeah, well, you started looking at this ideas of miraculous agitation?
No, that was a bit later. The miraculous agitation is something that I found quite recently as William said, the hinterlands of the unemployable. It's kind of despair, and you go, oh God, nobody will employ me now. And, I went to university. I think, oh, God, I mustn't be too arrogant about that. And then there's a kind of a resentment. You just resign yourself to, oh, no, I'll look in some bins. And then you begin looking and you think, hang on, so much stuff gets thrown away. And this was brought to my attention by, actually, was it you that gave me Empire of Scrounge by Jeff Ferrell, which is an American academic, published a book on trying to survive just on the things people throw away, which is more easy in America, I think, because it's a capitalist overproduction. So looking but at...
Was it at this point you became a book dealer?
Well, you're saying I'm not really... I'm a collector.
Like me. I include myself as the unemployable, actually. I'm not sort of...
I've said that you should do a show on book dealing. I'd love to listen to a show on book dealing and collecting.
Really, yeah, so. Yeah. Well, you could come back and we could talk about books more, perhaps. Yeah, but you're a bit concerned about giving away your trade secrets. Last time we spoke, you sounded like you were doing really well.
It seems to come in at the end of the month. There's always a little flurry of books, and there's a particularly good one that sold on cocktails, which went to a bookshop in London.
The Savoy Cocktail Book.
It was called, well, I don't know if I should say it, because it's called 1700 Cocktails by De Fleury, I think.
Right.
It's quite a rare book. I don't think there's any copies available at the moment from any dealers. That was quite expensive. The most expensive book I found, I mean, when I was looking in the bins, I'm looking for instruments, but the shops would use books as flat obstructors to place over the items. The scrap metal, people can't get the metal because the books are on top. They think the books would discourage scrap metal people.
Yeah.
But when I was looking through the books, you'd find these big books, and one of them was by D.R. Hay called The Harmony of Form, which is from 1850. It's a large, but I can't remember what's the technical term for a large, is it octavo?
It's elephant folio.
It's not elephant,
one.
No, it's not elephant folio. It's a folio.
Down to duodecimo or something. There's a whole...
I think it's a folio. I remember seeing it. It's called The Harmony of Form, I think. And it's a really expensive book. I haven't sold it. It's one I'm keeping. That's when I started collecting, I think. Yeah. I was thinking, these books are really interesting. They're being thrown away. So I began kind of collecting the books then and selling them. It just became a kind of chance thing that I just happened to be able to almost sustain myself by finding books.
But you also described earlier as playing a book. You've got some technique for actually making a... What was that? Can you describe that?
The bookophone, I call it. The bookophone is basically a book and a chrome piece of bar. It doesn't have to be a chrome bar, actually. It can be a piece of wood or a drumstick. And you run that across the foredge of the book. Usually it has to be it has to be a paperback, a modern paperback, preferably a fat, old, out-of-date law journal or something like that. An expendable book, because it does damage the book slightly. And then you just bring the chrome bar perpendicularly across the book, and it brings out these what's called shepherd tones, which is a kind of ascending... that's what it's called in electronic music, and it kind of these pseudo shepherd tones, and with some, I mean, there's a German guy who I don't know if he's still alive called Hans Reichel. He built the Daxophone from a piece of wood. All it is a piece of wood clamped down, and he managed to bow it and get these weird barking sounds from it. And he became quite adept at playing it, and he could get melodies from it. But I haven't been able to yet get a melody from the bookophone. I've got an example, actually. It's called Summer Song. It's called Summer Song because the sound of the bookophone changes according to the season.
Shall we go for that one next?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's all on books then?
Yeah, everything you heard then was on books. It's called Summer Song because the book sounds change over the seasons. In winter, it's much easier to get a sound from a book in that way by pushing this kind of chrome bar across it, because the book's the humidity is different. It's colder as the friction heats up momentarily. The book, it creates more tension, and it's much easier to get the sound from the book. In the summer, you have to try a bit harder, and you can hear the rhythms. Then I'm really trying to dig into the book with the bars. And so there's a winter song as well to go with that.
Right. Okay. Right. I'll just you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with Chris Weaver and Dan Wilson. Well, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Chris, you're going to
Basically, you've got a few more minutes left, and I know you're quite keen to display your sort of where your music are at. What you're working on at the moment, this miraculous agitation.
Well, I'm not keen too much because I haven't finished it yet. I'm always looking for the ultimate miracle sound. So I build by finding discarded objects, unpremeditated objects, just random things happen to be lying about, and then subjecting them to electromagnetic fields, non-contact fields.
So you vibrate them.
You resonate them, and it just causes them to vibrate. And then slowly adding obstructors in, you build up undertones and harmonics. I think this last track is just a kind of droning experiment when I just happened to find objects that harmonically correspond, and it's quite nice.
Which track number do we require for this to play out on? What is
Unlucky 13.
Oh, right. And what's this? What is this one?
This is the Miraculous Agitation Droner Experiment. It's untitled.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance FM. If you like what you heard, please support our work by making a donation at resonancefm.com/donate.